According to Dr. Sylvain Charlebois, one of the most important changes in the food supply network is social media. Consumers, he says, finally have a voice, and they're using it. They're talking a lot about food and where to buy it. Because in the past, the food relationship was a push from manufacturer to grocer and then to consumer. But he says now it's a pull in the other direction. And this, in essence, is putting tremendous pressure on the food industry in Canada. Charlebois says it's democratizing the supply chain, and it's giving everyone a chance to establish direct relationships between producers and consumers. And big-name producers like PepsiCo, Kraft Heinz, Gordon Food Services, and Sysco, to name but a few, are now selling directly to consumers. This shift in the relationship is also introducing food choices that didn't exist before, and that's because small or specialized producers couldn't access the market. Charlebois, who consults with food startup companies, says you will now see more and more small, specialized producers connecting online with consumers and offering them a wider range of products. I invited food specialist Dr. Sylvain Charlebois of Dalhousie University to join me for a conversation that matters, Food for Thought episode, about the dramatic changes underway in food production and supply thanks to consumer empowerment. Sylvain Charlebois, thank you for joining me for this episode of Conversations That Matter, Food for Thought. And food, of course, is something that we all need, and it's going through dramatic transformations around the world and in Canada. Give me a quick little state of the nation about where you think we are in our relationship with food.
It's a very macro starting point, but it is, food systems are vast and complicated. I would say this, we're at a point now where we weren't pre-COVID. I can tell you that a lot of things have changed, starting with our relationship with food. We have spent more time cooking, spending time at home. Grocers are trying to figure us out every single day, what we're going to be buying, what we're not going to be buying. The fact that the food industry was essentially closed for 2-3 months really got us thinking differently about food. And there are different channels being developed right now. Obviously, the food service industry, in order to survive, delivered food. Now, grocers are delivering food. Processors, farmer groups are delivering food to consumers. Everyone wants to connect with us. Meanwhile, we're vertically integrating. We have gardens. We are cooking. We want to take ownership of our own food supply chain. This fall, we're looking, when you look at social media, a lot of people are taking pictures of canning and the harvest that they've actually been able to produce in their own backyard. So there are a lot of things changing right now as we speak, and it's very difficult to tell you right now where we're going to be in just 6 months from now, because it's going to be probably very different. And one of the factors that could play a huge role is whether or not people will telecommute more. I'm thinking about major markets like in Canada, like Vancouver, Calgary, Toronto, Montreal. You're seeing more and more people buying real estate outside urban cores to get space, to be close to a lake. And frankly, more and more, your own personal address won't matter as much because your employer will allow you to work from home. And when that happens, less coffee shops, more gardening, more cooking. So lots of changes ahead.
You mentioned cooking a couple of times, and what I find quite interesting about this is a year ago you were saying people were cooking less and less to the point where they weren't buying utensils. They were eating out more and more. Like, this is a dramatic change. And I think it goes to demonstrate that it's very, very difficult to know what will be relevant 6 months from now or even 6 weeks from now.
Oh, absolutely. Actually, you're right. I mean, a year ago I was actually a little bit concerned. When you looked at sales for any instruments you would require to cook at home, sales were down, and they were actually dropping for many years. All the stuff you need to cook, flour, sugar, all those types of products, they were all down for many years. I didn't know that you needed a pandemic to get people cooking again. I just didn't know that. And I suspect that a lot of people didn't know that. And we got into baking all of a sudden as a nation in May and June. So absolutely, it's been a shocker. It's been a shocker for the industry, and it's been a shocker for us all. And so we're just about to go into the fall right now. That fall is absolutely charged with uncertainty, some anxiety. Kids are going back to school. We may actually be.
So the pandemic, of course, really forces our focus on health and well-being. And there has been this move amongst consumers in the past few decades to start to really understand the relationship between food and their own well-being. And so we've seen dramatic changes in the kinds of foods that are produced. People now say, well, I'm a vegetarian, or I'm a pescatarian, or I'm a flexitarian, which is a term that I hadn't heard until I heard it from you. We really are changing that relationship with food. Why is it important that we continue to do this post whatever comes of COVID-19?
The momentum, we saw a lot of momentum prior to COVID. The market was becoming more fragmented. The vegans, vegetarians, the flexitarians, and frankly, the flexitarian term I didn't coin, somebody else did. It was actually, it's been in the dictionary for about 4 years now. And I'm still not sure what it means, because everyone can be a flexitarian, really. I mean, when you think about it, it's just really a deliberate will to reduce the amount of meat you consume, whether you decide to eliminate meat or not. But there are different fragments emerging, which is interesting. And I've always believed that this is the future of food, actually allowing people to recognize themselves in the food system, and also allowing them to make choices. And that's how you generate growth. For decades, especially in Canada, there was a massive push strategy. We produce, here you go, Mr. and Mrs. Consumer, this is what you're going to eat. But because of social media, everything is turned around now. We're actually giving a voice to consumers, and they're being allowed to voice their opinions, their concerns about the food industry, about this industrial model we have in Canada. People question the model or different models, and that gets them to think about animal welfare, the environment. I mean, a lot of people actually see the planet on their plates every time they eat now, and that actually influences their choices. And I've always believed it's a great thing. So when I talk to cattle producers in Alberta or grain growers in Manitoba, they feel threatened by all the changes. And I always say this is the end of the stomach share era. This is not about you win, I lose, or I win, you lose. This is not about getting into everyone's stomachs as much as possible. This is about selling value, providing value to Canadians.
Right. So we're now starting to see this point where, as you point out, through social behavior, consumers are saying, well, hey, I want this, or I want that for these reasons, or I want to have a plant-based diet for this reason, and so on. Does that then put pressure back on the grocery store? But also, pre-COVID, was it putting pressure on restaurant chains to alter the offerings that would be available to the consumer?
Oh, absolutely. Right now, I think most people don't realize, but there is conflict within the supply chain for a variety of reasons. And it's been going on for a very long time in Canada, for many, many years, even pre-COVID. There's a lot of tension between grocers and vendors, suppliers, processors. A big conflict, and it's all about protecting consumers, giving consumers affordable foods as much as possible. And so in Canada, we have an oligopoly. It's basically five companies selling 85% of everything we eat at retail. So Walmart, Costco, Metro, Sobeys, and Loblaws. I mean, that's it. And they dictate what we eat. Meanwhile, processors have been undermined by this oligopoly for the longest time. They have the power. They can actually renegotiate terms. They have listing fees. They have fines. I mean, they're squeezing processors a lot. As a result, get this, Stuart, since 2012, okay, for 8 years now, we have lost 12 jobs a day, every day in food manufacturing since 2012. The sector is squeezed, and that's why we're importing more food from elsewhere. A lot of the food that we actually eat here in Canada that is being pre-manufactured actually comes from elsewhere because of that reason. Yes. And nobody has actually given any attention to that. And we saw it during COVID. Where was the problem? So we saw milk being dumped everywhere. We saw animals being euthanized. We saw potatoes spoiled, mushrooms spoiled, lettuce, and so on. So why? Because there was no processing capacity. And that was a big problem.
Well, as you're sharing that, I did an interview, reflected on an interview that I did earlier this year with a woman in Didsbury, Alberta, who is in the greenhouse business. And she opted out of the system. She said those major food manufacturer or purchasing entities said to her, well, this is what we're going to pay. And if you don't like it, too bad. And she went, well, I can't survive. So she took her products completely out of that system and has gone direct to consumer. Well, yes. she's making money, but how many people can she supply? She can supply those people who can afford to pay for that quality of produce. So how do we find that balance that says you're getting high quality produce that is going to allow the farmer to be sustainable? Just before I have you answer that question, I'll tell you, I went to Northern Saskatchewan and interviewed a farmer who has a rather interesting moniker. His name is Quick Dick McDick. You may have heard of him. And he was talking mm-hmm. about the fact, he says, I need to continue to expand the size of my operation because commodity prices haven't changed in close to a quarter century. So the only way that I can afford to do this is to produce more and more. And so this puts mm-hmm. the farmer in this incredible squeeze and deprives them of the direct relationship that they would have with the consumer.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I totally understand why this woman would do that. And this is what COVID is changing. It's democratizing the supply chain. It really is giving everyone a chance to establish a relationship with the consumer, really. And we've seen it. PepsiCo is selling directly to the consumer now. Sysco Foods, Gordon Foods, Saputo, Parmalat, Kraft Heinz, they've all decided to connect with the consumer and sell to consumers. And it didn't happen before. Grocers in Canada are great companies. And of course, they've been trying to sell high quality products. But at the same time, they do set rules when it comes to the financial model. And it really gives it's tough for processors to really break through.
Okay. So are those foods more expensive, though, because of this direct relationship rather than through the larger suppliers? Food costs are a big issue for Canadians. And we've seen year-over-year increases that are fairly substantial in the cost of food. We're not quite at the same percentage of income that Americans have, but we're creeping in that direction that this portion of our income is dedicated to food. And so how do we navigate our way through that balance? The person goes, yeah, I want that food, but I can't afford it.
It's a great point, Stuart. I would say the narrative around food inflation or food prices really changed in 2008 in Canada. Because when you go back to 1980, between 1980 and 2008, the general inflation rate and the food inflation rate, they were pretty much the same, really. It both followed each other until 2008. In 2008, all of a sudden, you saw this decoupling between the two. And the food inflation rate has exceeded the general inflation rate of our economy. And that's why people are talking more about food. They're noticing that food is more expensive. In 2008, the average household was spending about 9% of its budget on food. Okay. Now we're almost close to 10%. And because of COVID, because you probably saw numbers coming from Stats Can, the general inflation rate is at zero, but still the food inflation rate is almost at three. So that decoupling is increasing again. So we are expecting the average household to spend probably 12% of income probably by the end of 2022, which means that food security is a huge issue in Canada. It's only going to increase. Before COVID, one out of 8 hours experienced food insecurity over the last 12 months. That ratio increased to one in seven. So one out of seven households has experienced food insecurity since the start of the pandemic. That is a lot. That's 700,000 people more than before COVID.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how do we ensure that the food supply system in Canada is sustainable? Because there are shifts that are happening. We see people moving away from meat, looking for other plant-based and plant-based protein products. How do you support the farmers? How do you support the entire system to make those shifts and still leave the consumer with the sense that they have food security?
It's a good question. We need to be strategic. So our lab at Dal, we're actually currently working with three provinces looking at the exact issue you're raising right now. So Newfoundland, New Brunswick, and Quebec. And so we're looking at several facets of the food system. So one, production. And when we talk about production, we have to think about inputs, fertilizers, seeds, machinery. You need an ecosystem in order to support farming. And a lot of the work that needs to be done in Canada, frankly, is in horticulture produce. That's where we're the weakest there, by far. And so we have to look at horticulture. And then after that, you look at processing. How do you actually add value to what you're producing? And like I said to you, it was missing during COVID. And this is something that is being recognized right now by governments in Canada. So increasing processing capacity, investing, reinvesting in processing. And finally, of course, it's about developing markets, but not just domestic markets. You see, in Canada, we're only 38 million people. It's a very small number of consumers in a very vast territory. Distribution costs are horrific. We don't have any population density in Canada. So in Canada, if you want to develop food security, or if you want to make Canada or Canadians more food secure, you have to think about trades as much as feeding your own at the same time. The Americans don't have to do that because they're over 300 million people. They have a lot of mouths to feed. Europe is the same thing. Canada's unique in that way. You have to think about food security at the same time as thinking about trades to keep costs down as much as possible. You need to increase or better economies of scales to keep costs down and remain competitive in your own market.
So Murad Al-Khatib of AGT, based in
Who I
Saskatchewan.
know very well, by the way. He's a great guy.
Great guy. And there is somebody who saw opportunity that addresses those very points that you just made. There's a field laying fallow. How can we plant a crop that is regenerative, that adds value? We will mill and process, and we will deliver to global markets. And in doing so, address plant-based protein issues and so on. We need more people like that who are looking at innovative solutions to ensure that Canada is producing the kinds of foods that we need here, but also globally, because we are, even though we're, as you point out, we're importing more food, we're also exporting extraordinary amounts of food around the world to feed a growing population. And so we need that kind of innovation.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So Murad, I've been on panels a couple of times with him. He's just a great guy. I've called him in front of audiences the Wayne Gretzky of pulses, because he was on his own in the prairies developing something out of nothing, really. He saw potential, and he built this empire, AGT. It's a billion-dollar business. But on top of that, he brought more attention to pulses. Now we have a supercluster, PIC, Protein Industries Canada, headed by Bill Gruhl, who's a former student of mine in Regina. You're seeing investment from Nestle, from Rocket, from Merit Foods in Manitoba, thinking about processing, value add in that space, which is wonderful to see. Those are great successes that we're seeing. In Alberta, there's a protein plant being built right now. Some more investments coming into Alberta as a result of what Murad started years ago. Wayne Gretzky did that in California, went to California, and many years later, you saw many hockey teams there. That's why Murad, I think, is the Wayne Gretzky of lentils and pulses in the prairies. And it's a success story that needs to be repeated.
So one of the things that he pointed out when I interviewed him is that you can't do this without an intimate relationship with a wide array of technological inputs, information gathering, drones, artificial intelligence, research and development. And Robert Sake, who is wrote his fabulous book about Agriculture 5.0 or Food 5.0, points out the same thing. So how important is it, of course, that we continue to embrace that? Now, and you look at it on the farming side, but we also need to be embracing that same kind of technology in helping these plants be as productive and drought resistant and disease resistant as possible. And this creates a bit of a rub for a lot of consumers who go, whoa, okay, hang on a second, now you're going too far. How do we address that?
So that... It reminds me of this catastrophe we started back in 1994, where we introduced genetically engineered seeds in agriculture. Biotechnologies actually took over agriculture without consumers' consent, really. Moral consent, I mean. Genetic engineering, there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, actually, it's just wonderful technologies. And frankly, we need to use more of it. We need to do more research. But it's misunderstood by consumers. And I spent a week in St. Louis with a friend of mine, a plant scientist at Monsanto, before it was actually acquired by Bayer a few years ago. And I had the opportunity to talk to Hugh Grant, who was the CEO at the time. And, you know, I was there for a week to understand why Monsanto became the most hated company in the world, really. I mean, you just Google Monsanto, you see all these horrible logos of Frankenfood, and it was just horrible. And I asked him, listen, what, why, how did it happen? How did this happen? And he basically said to us, well, we didn't bother communicating with the public because science was on our side. Well, maybe science was on Monsanto's side, but is it really about science? Is it really about facts? Are we talking about perceptions here? Are we talking about fears? And those were mismanaged. When it comes to risk communication, you really have to look at fears. And we're seeing with COVID right now, I mean, the pandemic, we're actually making a lot of decisions based on little or no science. The masks, the gloves, the packaging, everything. I mean, it's really, risk communication, it plays a very, very important role in food, in agriculture. And companies that do fail actually end up with a very weak risk communication strategy. And that's what I mean about transparency. You have to establish a rapport with the consumers, or else you're going to repeat the same mistakes all over again. Look at genetically modified salmon. Right now, most Canadians would have eaten at least once or twice genetically modified salmon without knowing. That's going to come back and haunt the fish industry in Canada, and all of a sudden you may actually see a great number of consumers deciding to boycott fish in general, just because we just didn't bother explain the science.
Well, this goes back to your point earlier on when you say we live in a world of social media where people go, hang on a second, I think I just got scammed, or somebody gave me misleading information. And therefore, they start to communicate, and whether or not they're communicating accurate information doesn't matter. They're responding to the way that they feel that they've been treated. And this affects other people's behaviors. So it is vitally important that all of these organizations be as transparent and verbose, really, in sharing information that can help people make informed decisions.
Oh, absolutely. And when you talk about food, it gets easily emotional because food is about culture. Food is about traditions. Food is about family. It's about getting together. It's very emotional. The other thing that is interesting in Canada, I think, compared to other places I've been around the world, is that there is a malaise, I would say, between food and money. You can be a farmer. Farmers are great, but don't make too much money. You can be a processor, but don't make too much money. You can be a grocer, but don't make too much money. If you don't pay your people well, you're not a good company. You're not a good citizen. And so I think a lot of Canadians actually do have this discomfort of seeing a food industry making too much money. Where in the U.S., some people think like that, but the majority of people accept the fact that it is a capitalistic economy, and companies, in order to survive, they need to make money, which is mm-hmm. okay. In Canada, I think we're going to have to get a hold of that sentiment. And because if you don't allow the food industry to make money or to get comfortable in making money, and you won't see innovation anymore, and you won't see growth. And frankly, most importantly for us, you won't see jobs being created in rural economies, rural communities. And that's why kids are leaving rural communities. I'm one of them. I was raised on a farm and I had to leave town because I didn't want to be there because all my friends have left. So that we need to think about that a little bit more as we grow as a nation.
Well, otherwise we will not have the food products that we need, because you cannot grow food entirely by automation. Despite the fact that you look at the sprayers and spreaders and all of the farm equipment, and
the drones,
this is a rolling computer. Human beings still play a fundamental role. And if we can't create that environment where they're enjoying doing the work, well, then we run the risk of really compromising our own food security.
Oh, absolutely. And so we need to innovate. We need to incentivize the economy to do better. And if we don't, we'll go back to the 1950s where it's all going to be about meat and potatoes. And frankly, from a nutritional perspective, that's not desirable at all. So we did have food security for a while, but nutritional security is still an objective for the majority of people. And frankly, because of the economic downturn we're experiencing right now, a lot of people will suffer over the next year or so, and we have to think about them. We have to think about ways to make tomatoes affordable, cucumbers affordable, salads affordable as much as possible.
So let me come sort of full circle on our conversation here to come back to. So when we take a look at where we're at, there's a wide variety of things that we've discussed here, issues that need to be addressed. Do you believe that there is the willpower and the capacity to address these so that we can ensure that Canadians have food security in the decades to come?
I don't know. I don't know. It's, I mean, I would say that right now, I have hope. I've always had hope. It's just I see a lot of fighting going on, and that's really a problem we need to resolve. There's infighting within the distribution system. There's infighting. There's even fighting amongst farmers. I mean, if try to get a farmer which grows lentils in the same room as a farmer who actually ranches cattle. They're not getting along all that much these days. And sometimes, well, they have to go into the same room and talk about issues. And so I think we need to think about the market the same way. It's about a fragmented market. It's about a different market, a moving market. And embracing differences and diversity is desirable. You will make money if you actually recognize how diverse the market is. You can't really expect any beef. It's impossible. Cattle ranchers hate A&W with a passion.
So the three legs of the stool then really are the consumer, the manufacturer, and the producer being the farmer. They have to figure out how to work together so that they're not in conflict with one another.
You've been listening. Because you didn't mention the word government.
Yeah.
Listen, the three legs that you just mentioned, perfect. That's all we need.
Well, let's hope that we can achieve it. Because, you know, we all have stomachs that we need to fill, and we need those, we need that collective effort to ensure that, you know, we're meeting environmental considerations, that we've got sustainable food production, that we have affordable food with security. It's very complex, and I think that we all need to continue to pay more attention, rather than less. And I think that if we do so, we can remain hopeful, as you say you are.
Absolutely. Very yeah. Positive. Stay positive. We need to stay positive.
Yes. Well, thank you for taking the time to do this. I really appreciate it. This was a fantastic conversation.
My pleasure.